Wow. I'm Vic. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, guys.
Boy, what a lovely group. I don't think I've spoken in such a nice, large group since my last court trial, I guess. But I'm not on trial today, for the grace of God. You know, I'm here as a replacement speaker for Tomas. Tomas B. has been my speaker since 1989. He's got over 47 years of sobriety. Probably one of the greatest human beings I ever met. You know, he couldn't be here today. He's suffering from stage 4 cancer. And he's a trooper. You know, about 3 weeks ago, several guys that he sponsored had birthday meetings at the Alano Club. That's where we go to meetings. Alano, and I'd like to welcome all of you. If you're ever in Fresno, go to our Alano Club. It's got the oldest meeting in Fresno there. And the outside group is my group and Tomas's group. They call it the outside group because they used to do a lot of H&I work and go to the prisons. And so the guys, when they were released from prison, they said, where do you go? He said, go to an AA meeting. And so that was the outside. That's what they called it. I'm going to the outside. And that's how the outside group got its name. But he asked me to pick him up, to take him to this birthday meeting. And I said, are you sure you can do it? So we got his little walker, and we took him to the meeting and stuff. And it was an hour and a half meeting, you know. And I noticed that he had beads of sweat forming all over his forehead and on top of his head. And you know, he said, the meeting was about over, and he said, Vic, he said, I had a business meeting to attend after the birthday meeting. He said, Vic, can you be kind enough to drop me off at the emergency room? I'm not feeling so well. So I said, of course, of course. So I excused myself from the business meeting and took him to the urgent care there. I'm sitting in the waiting room with the doctor. And the doctor came in to him and started talking to him. And he said, how you doing? He said, not so good. So they asked the usual question. On a scale of 1 to 10, how you feeling? He said, I'm at a 10. You know? He never complained once in the meeting. He didn't complain when I was picking him up. You know, that's the kind of man that has sponsored me and taken me under his wings. One of the most unselfish, giving human beings that I've ever met. And I was lucky to follow in his footsteps. You know, I know you all came to hear Tomas speak, and he's got a dynamic, terrific message. And I feel bad for you guys. It's like we invited you to a filet mignon steak dinner, and then we serve you hamburgers and hot dogs. So I'll try not to be too much of a weenie tonight, okay? But, you know, I sobered up at the heck do they call it? Treatment center in Clovis, California, December 7th, 1988, it was. And the guy you see standing before you is nothing like the guy that walked into that treatment center in Clovis. You know, back then I was a little bit younger. Back then I had hair, long hair, as a matter of fact. And I was playing in a band, and I was working a little rinky-dink job for the Fresno Cable TV Company. I was selling cable door-to-door. And I thought I was hip, slick, and cool. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman, I only had a couple friends at that time, and you know, he knew me pretty well from work, and he came over to my little ransacked apartment. He said, Vic, I think you need a break. I go, yeah, I do. He says, you need a vacation, don't you? I go, yeah, I do. Vacation from your life. He said, I know a place where you can go, it's like a retreat. 28 days you can go, you got a warm bed and they'll give you meals. And guess what? You can collect disability checks to not have to work. I said, that's for me. So I didn't know what I was getting into, honest. I signed up, and it wasn't until I sobered up and the fog lifted about 3 days later that I figured out I was in a treatment center for alcoholism. You know? And that was my beginning of my journey, was there. And then, you know, that, I'm here to share my experience, my strength, and my experience, strength, and hope with you folks. And, you know, my experience started off in, of course, in youth. And I was born in Fresno, but my dad was a chronic alcoholic, and he was run out of town, and we ended up in San Jose, California, and that's where I grew up, in San Jose. And I've got two brothers and a sister, and I'm the oldest. And my earliest memories is... my dad went to Germany when I was a little, he was in the service. He went to Germany, and I remember living in the projects over on the west side of Fresno with my grandmother and my mom, and I have very vague memories. I remember going to church. It was a Catholic church, and going with them and going to church, and that was my first exposure to God. And back then, in Catholic, I don't know if any of you are Catholics out here, recovering Catholics, but back then the Mass was in Latin. I didn't understand a word they said. It was all in Latin. And then the only part I liked was sometime during the end, the priest would walk down the aisle with his chalice with incense, swinging it around. And I loved the smell of that incense. I thought, this is just great, you know, I love. But I never felt the presence of God. I didn't develop a relationship with God. Went through all the Catholic rituals. I even attended a Catholic university, University of Santa Clara, with Jesuits. I lived with the Jesuits there. And I never, ever, ever sensed the presence of God. You know, and growing up in that household, my dad got back from the service, got back from Germany, and, you know, in Germany, that's where he learned to drink. That's what he told me. He said he learned how to drink in Germany, and he came home, and, you know, God bless his soul, you know. He did a lot better than his dad did, but he was a raging alcoholic, a very abusive alcoholic. What I can say about my dad was he adored my mom. He loved the heck out of my mother. He was very, very caring and loving. But to his oldest son, I guess he took out his alcoholism on me, and he was very, very abusive with me. I mean, it was a rough childhood, to say the least. And I developed a lot of resentments against my father for the abuse I suffered and humiliation I suffered at his hands. You know, I remember one time I was playing with all my buddies in the front yard, and one of my little brothers called and complained, and my dad about me. So I don't know what he complained about, but my dad came storming out of the house, kicked down the screen door, tackled me and held my head underwater in the mud in front of all my buddies, just held my face under the mud there. And I don't even know what he was saying to me. I was just like, you know, it's very humiliating. That's one of the things. And then having to hide my body in junior high and high school. We showered back in those days. I don't think they shower in school anymore, but, you know, being ashamed of the marks on my body, you know, hiding those marks from the kids and from the teachers. So I had a lot of resentments against my father. As a matter of fact, I studied hard and graduated from high school at the age of 16. I got accepted to the University of Santa Clara in a math scholarship. Couldn't wait to get out of that house. So I started school way too young. I was a little boy, you know. And that's where my drinking really started, was in college. I dabbled a little bit in high school. My first drink was at my parents' house. I was babysitting my parents, and my dad always had Coors in the fridge. So the kids were asleep, I was up, and I thought, you know, I don't know what happened. I just thought, wouldn't a cold beer sound good? And I remember that first drink of that Coors beer, and I hated it. It tasted like the worst thing I could ever imagine. And the first thought that went through my mind was, how can my dad drink this stuff? It tasted awful. And so I took another drink. And about halfway through that can of beer, I had the most wonderful, magical, warm feeling that I've never, ever felt creep over my body. The world was okay. All my problems were gone. Everything was, I found the magic elixir. The next day, my brothers had sneaked into the hallway and saw me drinking Dad's beer and squealed on me, and I got the lickin' tar whipped out of me, so I didn't drink till I got out of the household. But when I got to college, look out. That's when really my drinking exploded. There at school, it was a Jesuit school. We went to school Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday was prayer and meditation day and study day for all the students. And then Thursday and Friday, we went back to class. Well, I quickly found the group that used Tuesday night as a mini Friday night. So we didn't pray and meditate on Wednesday. We suffered our hangovers on Wednesday. That's really where my drinking really took off and exploded. I dabbled with alcohol and I dabbled with drugs. You know, the school, I was on a full scholarship, but I don't know if anyone know about Santa Clara is like a pretty elite school, very, very expensive. And so most of the guys that were there were from very wealthy families. Like some of the guys I drank with, their dads were like vice presidents of Latin American countries, and I was way over my head, because I grew up poor in the ghetto, working class dad. My dad was a mechanic, and so it was really hard. I always felt less than. I always felt not as smart as, not as good looking as, and certainly poor, you know, going to school there. But the only comfort I ever found was with drinking and drugs. And I learned quickly that I had other problems as well, issues up here. I remember some guy at some party gave me some drugs. I didn't even know what it was. But I went on a high that just, we're in a Jesuit school, and I developed some kind of a psychosis that I was the next Jesus Christ. I went around blessing everybody, you know, thinking. And then when I came down off of that, the television was talking to me. I was a special character. And back then, there was the war in Vietnam. And, you know, the president would speak, and he was talking directly to me. He had messages for me. You know, I was out of control. And I had an old 61 Ford Falcon that I bought for $195. I would drive that car from the school to my folks and then back, and I'd always be drinking on the way back, and I'd park it, and guys would go to me and said, Vic, why are you riding the bus? You have a car. I can't find it. I lost my car. I couldn't remember where I parked my car. I still can't remember. I go to Costco. I still can't remember where I parked my car. So I lasted at school to about my junior year. You know, I dropped out of college on my junior year there. And at that time, I was dating my future ex-wife, Barb. And she didn't like me at all. She told me, alcoholics, we want what we want. And I wanted a girlfriend, you know. And she drove a nice MGB convertible. I remember the first time I met her, I talked to her outside the party that we met, and she didn't like me. She took off while I was talking to her. So I'm leaning over, talking to her, and she's driving down El Camino Real, dragging my butt, you know, hanging onto the car, you know. But we ended up getting together, and one of the finest women I ever met, you know. I can never say anything bad about my ex-wife. I think that's one thing most men here can attest to, that we may be lousy husbands, but we know how to pick good women, you know, to put up with us. Great women that put up with us, you know. And so I was married about 14 years. Matter of fact, I got divorce papers in 88 when I was at that treatment center, the ARC, out in Clovis. I got divorce papers served. And as a result of that marriage, I have two wonderful sons, Tom and Steve. And my oldest, Tom, is 40 years old, Steve, 35. And what I can tell you guys is the first few years of their life, they had a drunk, irresponsible dad. You know, I didn't pay child support, didn't visit them. That went on till I went into recovery. You know, and they're lucky they're alive. You know, I was not capable of watching kids. Matter of fact, once in a while, she'd drop them off at my apartment. There was no food in the house. At that point, I had one friend left, and that's because he owned a restaurant and would give me credit so I could buy my beer from him, Gordy. And I had removed all the racks from my refrigerator so I could, once a month, I would buy my beer from Gordy and stack it in. So the kids would come in. I remember my ex-wife, Barb, coming over. She opened their fridge, and she was appalled. There's no food. She goes, there's no food in here. I go, that's not a problem. There's a McDonald's down the road. So that's where I would take my kids. There was a Der Wiener Schnitzel and a McDonald's. I'd go feed my boys over there. And, you know, I'm amazed my son, Tom, survived my parentage. Yeah, I remember there was a pool there at the apartments. I remember swimming in the pool drunk, and I see a little blur at the end of the pool. I go, oh, that's odd. You know, and that's my son at the bottom of the pool, you know. Shit. He, to this day, he's afraid of water. Lousy dad. I remember I also had a bicycle at that time, and I remember giving him rides to McDonald's on the bike. And I remember one time he'd go, faster, daddy, faster, and I'd be going along, and we hit a bump once, and he flew up in the air. And I caught him midair, you know, driving. I remember we went to Millerton one time, and there was a little turnstile that I thought, I said, hey, Tom, hop on that turnstile. I'll give you a ride around the thing. He goes, okay, Dad. He gets on the turnstile. I turn it. He goes flying around. I grab him. I look over, and I had wheeled my son over a cliff. You know, alcoholic father, I got here, it was God's work, not my work. The fellow that I told you about that got me to the ARC was a very devout Mormon gentleman, and he knew what he was up against when he talked to me. You know, I'm an example of a colossal human failure. you know. I made a complete mess of my life. At the age of 34, all my scorecards were zero. Financially, emotionally, spiritually, I was a zero, you know. I always thought that God gives us one chance at life. You're born, you go to school, you get married, you get a job, and you got one shot at this deal. That's what I thought. And I knew that I had lost it all. I failed in all areas, and I didn't have any answers. The sad thing, the pathetic thing, is that I convinced myself that I was A-OK. When I got to the Ark, that's where my journey began. And for me, it was more of the educational variety, because I was not ready to quit drinking. I didn't even think I was an alcoholic, you know. At that time, I was still married. I had a girlfriend that was a nude model, ballet dancer, and, you know, she was my support system in the Ark. And I remember when I got out on the 28th day, you know, Dr. Deutsch looked at her and said, you know, this is one of the sickest guys that's ever come through these doors. She goes, my advice to you, honey, is that if he doesn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days, if he doesn't get a sponsor, if he doesn't work the steps, you run for the hills. You know, she's from Oakhurst, so you go back to Oakhurst. And I'm like getting very resentful. You know, doctor, I'm in the room. I can hear this. He goes, yeah, I know. So the first 30 days, did I go to 90 meetings in 90 days? Did I get a sponsor? Did I work the steps? Hell no. I'll show him I can do this deal on my own. So 30 days later, she kicks me out of her place. I'm walking down Shields Avenue with a paper bag with my cowboy boots and my clothes that I have, and I didn't know where to go. So I called up my buddy, Gordy, the one that's still talking to me, because I owed him money for the beer that I bought last time when I went. And I said, Gordy, can you give me a ride? Where do you want to go? Take me to the Alano Club. You know, on Friday nights at the Ark, that was our meeting, go-to meeting. Friday nights we'd go to a speaker meeting like this. And the only reason I liked going there, because they served coffee. And I liked the little buzz that I got from their AA coffee mud that we would drink. Take me to the Alano, you know. So he did. He took me and he dropped me off to the Alano Club, and they have meetings there at noon. So I went to a noon meeting, and you know, I saw the steps and the promises up on the wall there, and I thought you guys were some kind of a crazy cult, you know, that you were trying to indoctrinate me into God. How dare you, you know? And I'm one of these guys that when, you know, I got out of the Ark, I was voted most likely to relapse because I didn't do anything. I didn't want to do. I'm very rebellious. And I saw those steps and I said, I'll never do those. That's ridiculous. I knew that my life was unmanageable. And then that second step, restore me to sanity. Actually, that's the one that got me. Because you guys remember when I told you I was at school, at college, and I thought I was Jesus? I knew I was insane. I knew I had mental issues, big time. I felt like I was busted. I was outed. Oh, these guys know what I'm about here. You know. I had a lot of emotional pain at that time. You know, I told you I got divorce papers, didn't have where to go, barely hanging on to my job. I had problems up the wazoo. I had warrants out for my arrest. I had expired tags on my broken down pickup truck. Of course, I didn't have insurance. I hadn't filed taxes in years. I had a host of problems. A lot of problems. And I remember I needed to pick a sponsor. You know, the first guy asked to sponsor me was in the ARC. It was a parole officer. He had 2 years sobriety. And I asked him to sponsor me. I said, you know, hey, John L., I can still remember his name. Hey, John, can you sponsor me? He looked at me. He says, oh, hell no. I only got 2 years sobriety. You're too sick for me. Shit. And then I thought to myself, I'll never ask anybody else to sponsor me ever again. The humiliation. You know, so I heard Tomas speak at those meetings at the Ilana Club, and he always talked about God. He always talked about the serenity in his life, the peace in his life, and I had none of those things. No peace, no serenity. And so I thought, I'll ask Tomas to be my sponsor. And it took me about a month before I built the courage up to ask him. And I thought I'd be sneaky about it too, because I heard in meetings that a sponsor helps you work your steps. So I didn't want to ask him, will you be my sponsor? Him say, no. So I said, Tomas, do you think you could help me with my steps? He said, Vic, I'd love to be your sponsor. I go, yay. You know, and that was in 1989, yeah. And, you know, I'm a great example of how the program works beside yourself, because, you know, I'm a great example of how not to work the program. You know, I only do steps when I'm in pain and I need help. I don't know if you guys remember that old cartoon, some of you might, Tutu Turtle. There was a turtle that always get into this mischief and trouble, and then he'd cry out, help, Mr. Wizard, help me out of this jam I have. And the wizard would appear and then fix everything. That was me and my sponsor. You know, and so what his recommendation was, always work a step. You know, the hardest one for me was that fourth and fifth step. You know, because I had a lot of wreckage in my past. I don't know about you guys, but I had a lot of wreckage. Alcohol and drugs took me to places that no human being should go. You know, there was a lot of shame, a lot of guilt. I used to tell my sponsor, I feel guilty. He'd say, that's because you are guilty. So I avoided that fourth and fifth step. You know, thank God for the old timers. You know, Tomas is not a pushy sponsor. He lets you come to him for help. He doesn't offer help. And so there was a guy named Art S. They used to call him the step Nazi, an old guy. And Art used to come to me and said, hey, Vic, you worked that four step yet? No. Every meeting I'd see him, he'd bug me about that fourth step. Vic, you worked the first step yet? No, no. And then I started going to different meetings to avoid Art. And he'd pop up there too. So finally, to get him off my back, I just said, you know, Art, I don't know how to do a fourth step. I don't know. It's in the big book. I go, I still don't. He goes, well, I'll make it easy since you're such a dummy. He says, write some lists. You can write a list, can't you? I go, well, heck yeah, I can write a list. You know, he said, make some lists. He said, make a list of all the places that you lived at, all the addresses, locations you lived. Make a list of all the schools you attended. Make a list of all your jobs that you had. He said, make a list of all your resentments that you have. That was the long list, about 168. And then make your sex list up. He says, I want you to write down every man, woman, or thing that you had sex with. You know, and so I went home and I started those lists. And he said, then you take those lists and you go to the big book and you have the format. And because I was overwhelmed. I didn't know where to start. There was just so much. But once I made those lists, You know, an address would remind me of an incident. A resentment would remind me of an incident where I was wrong. A job, all the jobs I got fired from would remind me of incidents, so it did. So I wrote out my fourth step, and when it was done, I called Tomas. I said, Tomas, can we do our fifth? And I heard a lot of stories from guys about their fifth, how they go to their sponsor's house and they spend hours and hours going over their fourth step. And I'm like dreading this thing. I go, oh, God. Tomas says, meet me out at the Alano Club 30 minutes before the meeting starts. I go, 30 minutes? That's it? 30 minutes before the meeting starts. Because I'm so important that, you know, I need at least half a day to go over my fifth step. So he met there, and he read my fifth step, and that was it. That was it. He says, okay, you've done your fifth step. Now we go on to the sixth. You know, and I can tell you this is the most profound experience for me, is after that fifth step, the obsession to drink and use drugs vanished. It vanished. You know, and that was like a year into dry drunk sobriety. It vanished. If I wasn't drinking back then, I was thinking about drinking. If I wasn't using drugs, I was thinking about using drugs. I missed it. It was hard. It was work not to drink up to that point. But I remember driving my old beat-up pickup truck and remembering that that obsession to drink was gone, completely lifted. And it's never come back, knock on wood. You know, that's not to say that I'm going to stay sober the rest of my life. We do this deal one day at a time. Sometimes 1 minute at a time. I remember back at the Ark, I wanted to leave after a week. I didn't want no part of you guys. And an old timer was there in the institution, and he said, well, it was December 88. He said, you're getting ready to leave. I want the hell out of here. I don't want anything to do with this. He said, well, it's cold, it's dark, you know, foggy. It was foggy back then, cold and foggy in Fresno. He said, where are you going? I go, well, I don't know. How are you getting there? I'm going to walk. He says, well, it's cold. You're going to be walking in that cold. He says, you got a warm bed down the hallway. He says, why don't you go lay down and leave tomorrow? I said, that sounds like a good idea. I'm a little tired. You know, and so the next day, he said, did you drink yesterday? I go, no, I was here. He said, that's how we do this deal. One day at a time. Just for today, I'm not going to drink. Just for today, I'm not going to use drugs. That's how we do it. And that's how I did it for a long time. So when that obsession to drink, I was playing in a band back then. Remember I told you I was skinny with hair and I was playing in a band, and I still was playing with these guys, and we'd go on these little tours around the state, and you know, everybody else in the bus or wherever we were traveling in, they'd be drinking, and they'd be passing joints, and I'd get that joint, and I'd pass it over, you know? I didn't partake. You know, that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. He still is. You know, coming down here, my friend Bobby that I came with asked me, well, did you prepare? No. She goes, well, do you have anything written down that you're going to say? No. I said, I asked God to direct my language, to direct my thoughts, to direct my speech to you guys today. You know, today I have a relationship with the higher power that I've never, ever had before. And life is a lot easier today. I remember when I was working, I always had to wheel and deal and negotiate that, do this, do that. Today I just show up. I suit up and show up, and God does the heavy lifting for me. You know, it's so much easier today. Not to say that sobriety is easier. The road gets narrower as you get time. For me anyway, it's gotten a lot narrower. The path that I used to walk on when I got here was pretty wide. I had a lot of leeway what to do and get away with. Today, that path has gotten very narrow. But that's a good thing, for me anyway. You know? So the amends I was taught, the next steps have to deal with making amends. Making those amends. And again, I don't do a step unless I'm hurting. And so, you know, I got that little buzz off that fifth step and made a list of all the people I had harmed. And, you know, at the top of the list, of course, was my dad. My dad, you know, from the treatment, I hated that guy. I would never talk to him, you know. My mom was like a saint. My dad was the devil, you know. And I had to make amends to the guy. That was the hardest one. And I kind of took the easy route on that. I didn't make it face to face because I was afraid of all the anger that would come out while I did this amends. You know, I used to dream about killing my dad and burying him in the backyard and being worried that, oh shit, somebody's gonna find my buried dad in the backyard. You know, don't let the kids play back there because dad's back there. True. So I didn't want to do those amends in person in case I lost my temper with him. You know, he's an old man. So I called him up. I said, oh, by the way, my dad quit drinking while I was in college. I didn't even know he was an alcoholic. Duh. He quit drinking, but he didn't go to meetings. He kind of had the same experience that I had. He told me later on that he went to a place called Casa Nuestra in San Jose, and he asked this old-timer to sponsor him, and the guy says, hell no, I'm not going to sponsor you. So he said, F AA, I don't want anything, and he didn't. He's been sober, all dry, all these years. And so I called him up. I called him up. I said, Dad, I got to talk to you. He goes, yes, son. I go, well, I said, I want to make an amends to you. He goes, an amends? I go, yeah, Dad. I said, you know, I wasn't the best of sons. I told him, I said, I badmouthed you. I didn't like you. I spoke behind your back. I stole from you. I just wasn't a good son. And I apologize, and I'd like to be a better son going forward, you know? And there was dead silence on the other end of the line there. And so I'm sitting there. I'm still pretty new in recovery, right? So I'm sitting there waiting for him to do his amends, you know? Well, son, I'm sorry I beat the shit out of you while you were nothing. You know? So the thing that came out of my dad's mouth was, he said, still makes me laugh. He goes, son, you don't know how many years I've been waiting to hear them words. And so I says, yeah, Dad. But guess what happened? That's the thing about this program, is that we always get the opposite of what we think we're going to get in this program. You know, you give it away to keep it. You know, all those years of resentment against my dad, poof, gone. I can go see my dad. I can go give him a hug. You know, we lost my mom about 2.5 years ago. They were married 66 years. They were inseparable. You know, the agony that my dad must be going through on a daily basis, missing my mom. And he's by himself over on the coast. You know, today I call my dad every day. Hey, Dad, how you doing? Hi, youngster. You know, I'm willing to help him. I'm willing to love him. I'm the recipient of the amends. Even though I made the amends to him, I'm the one that's got the benefits of those amends. I'm the one that's free today. I'm the one that's happy, joyous, and free today. You know? That's my strength. My strength today is a result of working those steps. You know, they're designed to create a spiritual awakening within a human being. So I used to ask myself, so what's a spiritual awakening? You know, a bright light? No. For me, a spiritual awakening is a personality change. You know, I talked to Tomas right before I spoke to you guys, asking him if there was any words or comments he had for you. And his first comment was for them to send them my love and blessings, he said. And then the other thing he said was this. He says, we're transformed, not reformed. We're transformed, not reformed. He said, society tried to reform you and me, Vic, and they didn't have any luck at that. You know, courts and jails tried to reform me and no luck. But you guys were able to reform me, transform me, and I'm born into a new life. You know, I'm a totally different person that came in here. You know, when I went into the Ark, one of the things they do with the new intakes is they had a Polaroid camera and they take a picture of you when you walk through the door. You know, and when you leave, they give you the photo back. You know, I look like Charles Manson. Literally, I said, holy shit, who's this guy? That's you. You know, and then I wondered why when I went for walks, you know, the mothers would call the kids in off the street. Yeah, I was a scary character. Today, I don't think I'm so scary. I'm a little bit more soft. I'm a little bit more approachable. I'm a little bit more friendly. I'm a little bit more loving. I'm a little bit more kind. I'm a little bit more generous. And that's all because of you guys. You guys out here in the room today. You know, going to meetings and listening to your shares. Because I don't know how to be a human being. I don't. I'm a contrary. I go against everything. I'm antisocial. But you guys have softened me. You guys have shown me how to be a human being, how to be lovable and how to love. More importantly, how to love. More importantly, how to love. You know, I heard an Indian guru talking the other day. I only have an hour, so I got tons of stories. I mean, I'm scratching the surface here, but because I went through phases in sobriety, I was a vegetarian studying meditation from a Hindu guru. I gave up a guitar and I started playing conga drums. So I lived with an African family with Baba Jomo, who was a kind of witch doctor and played drums and stuff, and I went through all these crazy phases trying to find God, you know, when I was new in sobriety. And guess what? I found God right here. This is where I found God. This is where I found my relationship with my higher power. You know, the guru said he saw a guy eating a fish. And he says, why are you eating that fish? He said, because I love fish. He goes, oh, so that's why you take it out of the water, kill it, boil it, and eat it? Because you love the fish? He says, no. You don't love the fish. You love what it can do for you. You love the way it tastes. You love that it gives you nourishment. You don't love the fish. You love what it can do for you. Then he said, and a man meets a woman, and he says, I love that woman. No, you don't. You love what she can do for you. She can give you some gratification. She can give you some emotional support. She can cook for you. She can do things for you. But you don't love the woman. And the woman meets the guy and says, I love that guy. She goes, no, you don't love that guy. You love that he has a job and has a paycheck and can take care of you. He said that true love is when you give. Because we all love ourselves. We all love ourselves. That goes without saying. But when you give a part of yourself to another person. When you give a part of yourself to that other person. And you're inside that other person because of that gift and that love. And that is love. Love is giving. And that's what I've learned from you guys, is to give without any return in asking anything back. We give of our time to others, to newcomers, to sponsees. Some of us give of our monetary, you know. But this is where I've learned to love. This is a program and a language of the heart. You know, when I was young, it was all about, look at me, what I've got. You know, it was all about me and what I've got. And today it's not about that. Today God has blessed me beyond what I should have. And all that stuff doesn't matter anymore. What matters to me today, what brings me joy today is, you know, things like today, coming up and speaking with you guys. You know, there's no place on earth that I'd rather be right now than right here, up here, talking to you guys. Nowhere. Give me $1 million, no, I'll be right here. You know, and it wasn't like that when I was drinking and drugging. I always wanted to be somewhere else. There was a party, a better party down the street. There was something better over there. I was never happy or content inside my own skin. You know? And, you know, I continue to make those amends. And I found the hardest ones, I waited till the last ones. You know, and I'll share it, and I'm getting ready to wind up here. I'm looking at the clock. I don't want to go overboard. But one of the hardest ones for me anyway, remember I told you I didn't file taxes? I didn't file taxes for years. Holy crap. You know, and I had some good jobs for several years. I was a 1099, so I got the whole kit and caboodle check. You know, none of it went to anybody but me. And, you know, I was another amends that took a long time to make. You know, I thought I was going to jail, the prison, you know, tax prison. I just didn't know how to, that was another one. I didn't know how to tackle it. So a few years back, a guy came and asked me to sponsor him. And so I go, yeah, I'll sponsor you. You know, you start working the steps, and I found out he was a CPA. So I said, Doug, I know I'm your sponsor, but I need your help so badly. Done. You know, that boogeyman that I thought about, you know, I ended up getting money back. I said, shoot, I should have done this a long time ago. You know. Again, that's another one of those God things. You know. So, you know, what I've learned in this program is you just do one day at a time. You know, and then you turn it over to God every single day. You know, you ask God to direct, I ask God every morning to direct my thinking. You know, I ask God to give me the strength to whatever He asks of me that day, that I'd be willing to do it. I don't have to know how to do it, just be willing to do it. And I ask God to bring me folks that I can help on a daily basis, that I can give it away to. You know, and it doesn't have to be somebody in the program. If I see somebody on the street that asks me for food or money, to give. Today, I don't worry about money. I don't worry about those things anymore because I know God is taking care of me. And the more I let go and the more I put my faith and my trust in His hands, the easier my life becomes and the greater the rewards become. You know, I came in here bankrupt, you know. Nothing. I didn't have anything. Clothes on my back. It was like that for years and years and years. And today, you know, I own my own home. I got a nice place. I used to have a pickup truck when I got here. A friend of mine felt sorry for me and gave me his old beat up pickup truck. You know, the mufflers used to fall off it. I had coat wires holding on the mufflers, you know, and they'd fall off. I'd have to run out, grab them hot mufflers, put them in the bed of the truck and wire them up when I got home, you know. It's not like that today. Today, I've got 5 vehicles, you know. They're all licensed. They're all insured. I have a driver's license today. I used to hate driving those side streets, looking in the rearview mirror, you know. You know, and then, of course, the jails. That's another story for another day. You know, I thank God every day for this program, you know. And if whatever position or stage of your recovery you're in today, what I can assure you that God has better things in store for you. And all we have to do is not drink and not take that drug. And it doesn't matter how fast or how slow you work the program, you will work the program. Thank you for listening to me today. Thank you, guys. God bless you all.